I was born in 1946, actually in Manhattan, on the same day as Donald Trump, same hospital. I just found that out, and I don't know quite what to make of it. I was born 10 months after the war ended in the Pacific. My first memory of hearing anything on the radio were reports of the Korean War. I was an undergraduate during the Vietnam War. In the island of Cyprus, we were there until Turkey invaded the island in 1974. And I can remember sitting on the front porch of our apartment in Famagusta, a port city, and watching an American-built Phantom jet circle the harbor. And then I saw something come out of the jet that went like this. And I said, "That's a bomb," which it was. Time to go inside. We were then refugees from that city. The Turkish army captured the city. I went back in and had my own adventures trying to get some belongings out. Later on, I was picked up in the mountains by Greek paramilitary forces, arrested, taken to a village, and interrogated as being a CIA spy. On my way home, I went home through Belfast. When people in Belfast said, "You're from Cyprus, right? Are you out of your mind? Why would you come to Northern Ireland?" Because that was where the Irish Republican Army at that point was causing a lot of trouble. So I was happy to get back to this country where things are peaceful, mostly. Jesus and war. I'm just going to look back about 60, 70 years. Gandhi in India cited Jesus. Martin Luther King in the American South cited Jesus as an authority to justify their approaches. Liberation theology in Latin America cited Jesus as an authority. Solidarity in Poland that helped to lead to the overthrow of the communist government in that country and the eventual unraveling of the Soviet Union cited Jesus as an authority. The Chinese government in our day is actually terrified of the Christian church in China. And in a somewhat different vein, when I was in elementary school in the Upper Darby school system outside Philadelphia, I remember in a book of patriotic songs learning to sing "Onward Christian Soldiers Marching Off to War." It was a good marching song. When I was an undergraduate at Swarthmore College, a traditionally Quaker school, after I switched from being a physics major to being a history major, I spent some time in their peace collection in the library. And they had an awful lot of Quaker writing and anti-Quaker writing about Jesus and war. Was Jesus a pacifist? Would he have supported the later Christian doctrine of just war? And so on. One thing that impressed me as a history major, even at that time, and more so in retrospect, is how completely lacking in any historical sense most of the writing was. On both sides, Jesus' words were treated as sort of timeless oracles, not as things that he said in a particular time and place. Now, I'm not going to directly interact tonight with the pacifist or the anti-pacifist writings that are an awful lot in Christian history. But what I want to do is examine in the context of his time and place the things that Jesus taught which might have a bearing on war. So we need to locate Jesus historically. Jesus was, first of all, a Jew. Second, he lived in Palestine. Third, he lived from about 4 B.C., that's always a little uneasy for people to quite grasp. He was probably born 4 years before Christ, and yeah, I need to help you with that. All right, he was born 4 years before Christ and died somewhere around 35 years later. The Roman governor of Judea, the southern province of Palestine, had him executed about the year 30 A.D., Now, any discussion of what Jesus taught immediately raises the question of the reliability of our sources, notably the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There is by now a long scholarly tradition that views these books with deep suspicion as the product of the traditions and life of a later Christian church, but not real history. Perhaps a process of demythologizing, to use a Bultmann's term, would allow scholars to discern some underlying kernels of Jesus' teaching beneath the layers of elaboration that church tradition had added to them. But to take the Gospels as they stand as reliable reports about what Jesus did and said was just naive. Following in this same tradition of skepticism about the Gospels, just in recent years, something called the Jesus Seminar made a lot of noise in this country. New Testament scholars getting together and voting on each thing Jesus is recorded to have said as to whether he really said it, he probably said it, he might have said it, he really didn't say it. And critics of their work have observed that what he most certainly said definitely makes him a good Democrat. And what he definitely didn't say would have made him just an awful Republican. Now, this scholarly tradition of skepticism treated the assumed oral traditions behind the Gospels as though they were like a manuscript that had gone through many editorial hands. Then the Gospels, as we have them, finally emerged from some anonymous compilers in the late first century, and somehow famous names like Matthew and John were attached to them. Now, I want to say that I was certainly familiar with this skeptical take on the Gospels as an undergraduate history major, and that skeptical take just never satisfied me. Powerful works of literature do not emerge from the folk, contrary to the theories of early folklorists. Some individual always writes them. Furthermore, the time needed for an oral tradition to produce the demythologized Gospels never seemed to me to be nearly long enough. People who actually knew Jesus were still alive when the first Gospels were published. Just not enough time for what they said happened to have possibly happened. If you take away anything from my talk this evening, one thing I'd like you to take away is the name of this book. It's a recent book by the English scholar Richard Bauckham, published in 2006. And he confirms my skepticism of the skeptics. He puts a thoroughly argued, and I mean thoroughly argued, final nail in the coffin of mainstream gospel studies of the last century. There had already been some nails hit into this, but he finishes it off. Entitled Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, Bauckham's book argues persuasively that the Gospels contain the testimony of Jesus' closest associates. They were written according to the canons of mainstream Greco-Roman historiography of their day. They were not the product of church tradition or later life, and indeed they contain a lot of material that was not germane to later church life. The Gospels tell us what Jesus did and taught as he traveled through Palestine. Now, obviously, I'm not going to repeat Bauckham's arguments this evening, but if you have an interest in reading a densely written and fully acquainted with all of the scholarly literature work that, as far as I'm concerned, ends that skeptical take on the Gospels pretty thoroughly, that's the book to look at. Richard Bauckham, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. So, in my talk tonight, I am going to take the Gospels as they stand as my sources for what Jesus taught about war. They describe a popular teacher and healer, calling himself the Son of Man, who gathered a varied group of disciples about him. After several years of itinerant ministry, mostly in the northern province of Galilee, he ran afoul of the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem. They handed him over to Governor Pilate, charged as a potential threat to Roman peace. Pilate had him crucified outside of Jerusalem. 3 days later, Jesus rose from the dead, commissioned his disciples to spread the announcement of his saving reign to all nations, and to teach new disciples what he had taught them, and left this world. So, what did Jesus teach about war during his itinerant preaching throughout Palestine, the provinces of Galilee, Samaria, Perea, and Judea? That's our question tonight. And the canonical four Gospels are our sources. Palestine in the days of Jesus. It was at peace, but an uneasy peace. When Americans today hear the word war, we think first of international conflicts between state-supported armies, or second of our own country's civil war, which began about 150 years ago. The Roman Empire, of which Palestine was a small part, knew both kinds of war. But not in Jesus' day. What the English historian Edward Gibbon first named the Pax Romana began in 27 BC with Augustus' final victory over Antony in Rome's civil wars. The peace lasted, in Gibbon's accounting, until 180 AD, two full centuries. In those two centuries, Rome and its provinces faced no significant external enemy, expanded their borders only slightly, and had no major civil wars between rival claimants to Rome's throne. There were occasional border troubles with the Germans to the north and the Parthians to the east, which the Roman legions managed with relative ease. There were also two important Jewish revolts, which we will get to later. Not long before Jesus was born, the Jewish Hasmonean dynasty, its dates are 164 BC to 63 BC, about 100 years, ruled an independent Palestine. If you are familiar with the Old Testament, you know the Old Testament closes, the Protestant version of the Old Testament, closes with the little province of Judea under Persian rule. And then the New Testament opens with Palestine under Roman rule. But there are 400 years in between, and in those 400 years, first you had Alexander the Great come and conquer that piece of territory from the Persians, indeed end the Persian Empire, and then leave successor Greek dynasties in Damascus and Egypt to fight over the territory in Palestine. And then for 100 years, the Jews had an independent kingdom of their own, ruled by a dynasty begun by the Maccabean father and five sons. They had a successful revolt against Hellenizing Greeks from Syria that, for the Jews of Jesus' day, was recent history, about as far back for them as the Civil War is for us. And you're aware how fascinated Americans remain with our Civil War. Some more, some less. I know some reenactors, maybe you do too. Battlefields that are famous. We still know the names of the famous generals. You got Lee in the south and Grant in the north. We passed a street as we came into town, Lincoln Avenue or something. The American Civil War is still very much with it. The Maccabean fight for Jewish independence was still very much in the Jewish mind in the days of Jesus. By the way, if you're trying to connect the Maccabean revolt against their Greek rulers, the Jewish festival of Hanukkah commemorates the resumption of worship in the temple after the Maccabees had cleansed it and expelled the Greek armies. At Jesus' birth, Herod the Great, the successor of the Hasmoneans, was, quote, king of the Jews, quote, by order of the Roman Senate. He answered to Rome. He was a brilliant politician and a brilliant builder. In fact, he's the builder of the temple that Jesus walked in. And as a politician, he had sided with Antony in the Civil War. And so when Augustus beat Antony, Herod the Great was in a difficult situation, and what he did was immediately run as fast as he could to Augustus and say, "You know how loyal I was to Antony, your enemy. I will be just as loyal to you." It worked. Palestine under Roman rule was peaceful and prosperous and had a rapidly growing population, especially in Galilee. Now, after Herod's death, the province of Palestine was divided into three or four pieces. And at the time of Jesus' death, Judea in the south had a Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. He was governor from 26 to 36 AD. And Herod Antipas, one of Herod the Great's sons, was the ruler of Galilee. He ruled Galilee from 20 to 39 AD. To maintain order and to protect the empire's borders, Rome usually had a cohort made up of 6 centuries stationed in Jerusalem. That would be about 500 to 600 men. And they were stationed in barracks right next to the temple. There was a larger force of several cohorts stationed at Caesarea Philippi on the coast. And there was usually a legion or more. That could be 5,000 men, or if it were a fully filled out legion, 7,000 or 8,000 men in Damascus to the north. So in a territory about the size of Maryland, you had 7,000 to 8,000 Roman soldiers. Jesus one time personally dealt with a centurion in Galilee. He came to Jesus asking him to heal his servant. Jesus said to him, "I'll come." He said, "You don't need to come with me. I too am a man who understands authority. And if I say to a servant, go, he goes. And if I say, come, he comes. You just say the word, and my servant will be healed." It was the commander of the Roman cohort in Jerusalem who sent some of his troops to oversee Jesus' arrest. Now, given the general peace between and within nations in Jesus' day, it is to be expected that Jesus would have little to say directly about war. I think he probably said very little about war in the large sense that we usually think of it. I can only find one reference to war in Jesus' teachings that involved a large army marching against another large army. Here it is in its entirety. "Now great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Or what king, going to make war against another king, does not first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple.'" Here Jesus uses war as an instance of planning and foresight and then taking appropriate action. He's making no judgment at all about war itself. One other time, Jesus refers directly to what we usually think of by war when we hear the term. In talking about the future with his disciples, he mentions wars as troubling things to be expected in human affairs. But arresting as the wars are, they should not trouble his disciples, he said, nor make them think that the end of the world was near. Here it is from Mark's Gospel. "But when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be troubled, for such things must happen, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom." Now, we're going to look at Palestine again. It was peaceful, it was prosperous, and it was restless. While Palestine was peaceful under Roman oversight, the Jews were not content with Roman rule. Many of them longed for a hero like the Maccabees who would free them from Roman rule. One indication of that longing for a hero is revealed in the names they gave to their sons. Now I'm going to shift our focus for a moment to a small province of the Turkish Ottoman Empire. Rich mentioned that I did history work in Near East events in the 19th, 20th century, so this is what I spent a lot of my time working on. Around 1800, the Ottoman governor in the small town of Athens wrote back to Constantinople that the Greeks were up to something. They were starting to name their sons Pericles and Achilles rather than Peter and John. By the way, this is a very famous and perceptive note by a governor. In 1813, a teacher in Athens sponsored a ceremony in which he held olive and laurel branches in his hand as he renamed his students. He said, "From now on, your name will no longer be John or Paul, etc., but Pericles, Themistocles, or Xenophon. For the rest, fear God, help your fatherland, and also love philosophy." 8 years later, in 1821, a Greek revolt of exceptional brutality, inspired in part by European classicism and by the ideals of the French Revolution, broke out against the Ottoman rulers. names taken from classical Greek history rather than from the Orthodox Church saints, were an early indicator of the rebellious mindset of the Greeks. What names were the Jews giving their children in Jesus' day? And what might those names indicate about popular sentiment? Well, in 2002, an Israeli scholar published a book in which he had hunted through every possible literary source, every burial inscription, old papyri such as legal documents and so on. And it's a book with a just mind-numbingly dull name. Lexicon of Jewish Names in Late Antiquity. Part 1. He gathered 2,625 male names and 325 female names. The most popular male names in an ancient period in Palestine. Surrounding the life of Jesus, he's got Jesus' era bracketed pretty well. He starts in 325 BC, ends in 200 CE, as he calls it. The most popular names were Simon, Joseph, Judah, Eliezer, Yohanan, and Joshua. The most popular female names were Mary and Salome. Readers of the Gospels will, of course, recognize these names. The name Simon, for example, was so common that the Gospel writers regularly attached a second identifier to it so that readers could keep track of who is who. There was Simon Peter and Simon the Zealot, two of Jesus' disciples. Simon the leper, who lived in Bethany. Simon, one of Jesus' brothers. Simon of Cyrene. Simon Iscariot, the father of Judas Iscariot. The book of Acts adds Simon Magus and Simon the Tanner. The next name on Ella's list, Joseph, is familiar as Joseph, the husband of Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Joseph of Arimathea, in whose tomb Jesus was laid. Mary was the most common female name. In the Gospels, there is Mary, the mother of Jesus, Mary, the sister of Martha, Mary Magdalene, and Mary, the mother of Clopas. Now, here's what's interesting about these names. Six of the top nine male names are from the Maccabean family. And the most popular female names are from the Hasmonean dynasty. Father Maccabee was Matthew, and his sons were John, Simon, Judas, Eliezer, and Jonathan. Mary and Salome, of course, are from the women in the family. Those of you who know the Gospels, have you ever noticed in the Gospels, no one is named David? No one is named Moses. No one is named Elijah. Now, why might that be? They are certainly prominent in the ancient history of Israel. And you might think that pious Jews who read the scriptures would name their sons after people like David. They did not. There are none in the Gospels. There are none in the ancient Jewish sources. You take those 2,625 male names, there's not a David among them. There are lots of Davids in our society, but there are no Davids back then. Here is a possible reason why. Palestinian Jews, longing for a Messiah to deliver them from Rome, knew that the scriptures promised a coming messianic age. And Hebrew prophecy indicated a prominent role in that age for Moses, check Deuteronomy 18:15, Elijah, check Malachi 4:5, and a number of references in the Gospels, and David, check several dozen sources. It seems that no one dared name a son David, Moses, or Elijah. It would have been presumptuous. But they could and did name their sons after the Maccabean heroes, who had defeated Palestine's Greek-Syrian rulers just 150 years before Jesus was born. Now, many of you probably know that a generation after Jesus was put to death, in 66 AD, the Jews did rebel against Rome. They wiped out the Roman garrisons in Palestine. That is, they killed every last Roman soldier. Reminds me of how the Greek rebellion began. The Greek rebellion began in Athens, and they besieged the Turkish garrison there in Athens. And when the Turks realized there was no help coming and they were doomed, they agreed to surrender under safe conduct. And as they walked out of the garrison, the Greeks killed every last Turk. That's how they got started. So the Jews killed every last Roman soldier in 66 AD. Then when the legion stationed in Damascus came south to restore order, they destroyed it just as thoroughly. They held out for 3 years against four Roman legions under generals Vespasian and Titus. After finally conquering Jerusalem in 69 AD, the Romans destroyed the temple that Herod the Great had built and brought an effective end to temple worship. 60 years later, in 132 AD, the Jews tried again. Under Bar Kokhba, who claimed to be the Messiah, they again rebelled against Rome. The war again lasted for over 3 years. And after that war, the Romans forbade any Jews to live in Jerusalem at all. And so for the next several centuries, Jerusalem was a strictly Gentile city. No Jews allowed to live there. Now, here's the question. War is not an issue in Jesus' day. There's peace. But a rebellion against Rome, that's in the air. What stance did Jesus take towards a popular hope for a successful rebellion against Rome? And I'm going to say and argue that he gave no encouragement to the Jews to rebel. Furthermore, he rejected a messianic role for himself as leader of such a revolt. And finally, he prophesied that the Jews would rebel nonetheless, only to be disastrously defeated. The Gospels consistently record Jesus' opposition to a military revolt, despite the legal record of Jesus' execution, where you remember the charge posted over his cross was King of the Jews, exactly the title that Herod himself was given by the Roman Senate. In at least three instances, Jesus spoke clearly on the side of Jewish acceptance of Roman rule. The first place is very familiar to readers of the Gospels, but often we miss what he's actually saying. It's in Jesus' famous Sermon on the Mount. Here it is from Matthew chapter 5, verse 41. "And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too." Have you ever thought reading that? That's an odd thing to say. You get it when he says, if somebody slaps you on the right cheek, give him the other cheek also. All right, that you get. But if somebody compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. What is that? Early version of carjacking and you go along? Here is a more interpretive translation. This is from the Today's English version, which was popular about 30 years ago. "And if one of the occupation troops forces you to carry his pack 1 mile, carry it 2 miles. What's behind this? Well, Roman law, following Persian and Greek precedent, provided that a Roman soldier could require a subject, or his donkey, or his wagon, to carry his pack and provisions 1 mile. That law of legal but limited forced labor was the basis for forcing Simon of Cyrene to carry Jesus' cross for him. Remember, the Roman soldiers found somebody named Simon and they forced him to carry Jesus' cross. The law said they could demand that. "Now as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, I read from Matthew. Him they compelled to bear his cross. So when Jesus said, if someone compels you to go 1 mile, go too, what he meant was, if a Roman soldier tells you to carry his equipment, not only should you not refuse and make an issue of it, you should go twice as far as required." There's a second time that Jesus taught cooperation with Rome, and that was his famous saying concerning taxation. A week before Jesus' arrest, the Herodians, basically collaborators, and the Pharisees, basically scornful of the collaborators, got together to ask Jesus this question trap. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? The point was to implicate Jesus with the Romans if he said no, or to cost him popular support if he said yes. Jesus asked for a denarius. They gave him one. He held it up and he asked, "Whose name and image does it bear?" And they answered, "Caesar's." That would have been most likely Tiberius Caesar. And then Jesus' famous reply to the question trap was this: "Well, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." In other words, in a very clever response to evade a bald yes, what does he say? Pay taxes. In the ancient world, of course, for a subject country to refuse its payments to the ruling country meant rebellion. This is how you signaled that you were no longer going to follow the ruling country. You simply didn't send in your taxes or your tribute. So again, Jesus urges no rebellion. In a third instance, at least, when he was arrested and Simon Peter pulled out a sword to fight the arresting Roman troops, Jesus told him, "Put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword." And then Jesus healed the ear of the high priest's servant Malchus, which Peter had cut off. And after Jesus refused all resistance, his disciples fled. One further comment by Jesus is revealing about his stance, which he took towards the Romans. On one occasion, people told him about a recent... You know, I'm going to switch for a minute and talk about 9/11. I'm going to play the role of Jesus, asked about the people who died on 9/11. So, what do you think about the people who died on 9/11? Did you hear about that? Planes flew into the Twin Towers in Manhattan, came down, and killed thousands. Here's the answer. And do you think those people were any more wicked than the people in Japan who were killed by the tsunami? That's quite an answer, isn't it? You're wanting to know, what do you think about the Arabs who did this? Do you think the Arabs actually did it? All right, and he put the focus on the people who died. Are they any more sinners than those who died in the tsunami in Japan? All right, here's the quotation from the Gospel. On one occasion, people told him about a recent atrocity in Jerusalem. This is from Luke's Gospel, about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. I hope you get what that means. They've gone to the temple to worship, and they run afoul of Pilate's troops, and he kills a bunch of them. In reply, rather than excoriating an unpopular and brutal governor, Jesus directed his hearers' attention to Pilate's victims. He asked, and now I quote, "Do you suppose that these Galileans were worse sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered such things? I tell you no, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish." And then he drove home the point with a reference to a recent disaster that they all would have known about, the sort that our insurance companies call an act of God. Of those 18 on whom the Tower of Siloam fell and killed them, do you think that they were worse sinners than all other men who dwelt in Jerusalem? I tell you no. But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. You can look this up in Luke chapter 13, the first 5 verses. Undergirding Jesus' policy of not encouraging rebellion against Rome, indeed discouraging it, seems to have been an acceptance of the legitimacy of Roman rule. First, Roman power had a divine source. When Governor Pilate asked him as he stood on trial before him why he remained silent, given that Pilate had the power to release or condemn him, Jesus replied, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above." Second, the Jews readily made use of the benefits of Roman rule. In his reply about paying taxes, Jesus, by asking for a Roman coin, which they readily produced there at the temple, seems to imply the principle that since the Jews used Roman coinage, they rightly owed him tax. By the way, John Locke reasons it exactly the same way where roads are concerned. He says, if you use a country's roads, you've accepted their rule. Finally, Jesus rejected all mob efforts to treat him as a messianic warrior hero or political ruler. After the feeding of the 5,000 in Galilee, the people were ready to come and make him king by force. That's John chapter 6. Jesus fled. He refused to cooperate. When Jesus asked his disciples who the people said he was, they answered, "Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." Now again, if you know the Hebrew Scriptures, the fact that people thought it was Elijah is not surprising. The fact that people said John the Baptist is not surprising. John the Baptist had just been there shortly before Jesus. What's Jeremiah doing on the list? And the usual explanation is, well, Jeremiah was the weeping prophet, and Jesus also was sorry about his people in many places we read. But I think there's a different possible reason. The surprising name is Jeremiah, but maybe not so surprising in this light. Jeremiah was the prophet who insistently counseled Judah's submission to Babylon against the popular determination to resist Babylon, a resistance that finally led to the destruction of David's city and Solomon's temple within it. And who did they think he was? Who did his disciples think he was, he then asked. And Peter replied, "You are the Messiah." Mark chapter 8:29, it's in all the Gospels. And then, rather than sending them out to proclaim his identity and gather a force behind him, Jesus told them categorically not to tell anyone, adding to his disciples' discomfiture that his destiny was to be rejected by the Jewish leaders and put to death. Now, Jesus repeatedly indicated that the Jews would in fact rebel against Rome with disastrous results. As he entered Jerusalem for the last time, he wept over the city, prophesying, and this is from Luke 19, "For the days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment around you, surround you and close you in on every side, and level you and your children within you to the ground, and they will not leave one stone upon another." Sitting outside its walls later, he told his disciples, who were marveling at the splendor of the temple that Herod the Great had built, not to be impressed. The days were coming when it would be all torn down. As he went to his death, carrying his cross through the streets of Jerusalem before Simon took it over, he said to the lamenting women, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and your children." Well, what about the Roman verdict that Jesus was a political rebel, the one posted above his cross, King of the Jews? Because the point of that accusation is rebel against Rome. The Gospel writers insist that the verdict was unjust, the result of Jewish pressure on a vulnerable governor, Pilate, the result of a cowardly miscarriage of justice by the governor. Their summary of the Jewish leaders' dislike of Jesus is that it stemmed from envy and fear that Jesus, by his popularity, would provoke a full Roman takeover, leaving them no further room for local rule. The Gospels portray Pilate as trying to find some way to release Jesus or to at least impose a lesser sentence than death, but as giving way when the Jewish leaders threatened to report him to Caesar for letting an enemy of Rome go free. Finally, as Jesus pointed out when he was arrested, he had not been acting like a rebel leader. For a week prior to his arrest, he had taught publicly in the temple, where the Roman garrison stationed next to it could have easily arrested him. And while he sometimes attracted crowds, he never gathered an armed force. His disciples had all of 2 swords among them. Now, one can, of course, prefer the Roman verdict to the Gospel accounts, but the Gospel accounts are quite consistent. Jesus not only did not advocate or try to lead a war of national liberation, as we would say today, he actually opposed such a war and foretold that it would lead to disaster. And he accepted Roman rule as legitimate. In summary to this point, I don't want to get your hopes up. In summary to this point, what did Jesus teach about war? Concerning war between sovereign nations, nothing at all. Concerning a war of national liberation for the Jews against Rome, he stood against it. Why was Jesus, who accepted the title of Messiah from his close followers, even while in public he called himself the Son of Man, opposed to a war of national liberation? Many reasons could be suggested. Most obviously, and I've already said it, Jesus foresaw that the Jews would lose such a war as they did 30 years later. More importantly, I think, Jesus had an interpretation of Scripture prophecy that identified the Messiah, son of David, with the suffering servant of Isaiah, who would die for his people. Unfortunately, we do not have time to develop that line of thinking tonight, but it is central to Jesus' thinking. I'll just repeat it again. I think the central reason he doesn't support a war of national liberation with himself as the Son of David leading it is that he identified Son of David with suffering servant of Isaiah, who would in fact die for his people. Finally, Jesus' opposition to a Jewish war of national liberation rested on his goal of a more thorough transformation of human existence than such a war could possibly accomplish. Jesus came to create a renewed world where the motives for war are subverted. Many years ago, I listened to a man who had been a missionary to China, and he had learned Mandarin. He gave me his Chinese Bible with Chinese on one side, English on the other. He had specially bound for himself, and it's an interesting document. He's got his sermon notes in throughout there. He was in China in 1949 when the communists took over, and this man's name was Sam Boyle. He read all of Chairman Mao's works in Chinese, and he wanted to know, what is the secret of the power of the Communist Party that they are steamrolling right over the Christian church and over all of China? He was a remarkable man. He went from there to Japan, which had killed millions of Chinese just a few years before in World War II, and was a missionary in Kobe, Japan. He learned Japanese, so he then preached in Japanese. Well, the experiences like that, every time I heard him, I would remember something that he said. And I remember a talk he gave once in which he began with a jar sitting up here with about this much of dirt at the bottom. And he started his talk. He took the jar, shook it up, turned it upside down, and left it there. It was all muddy. But by the end of the talk, all the soil had sunk to the bottom, but it looked just the way it had it before. And he said, this is what revolutions accomplish. And sure enough, the Communist Party soon was just as oppressive and dictatorial as the people whom they replaced. Now, Sam Boyle reflected Jesus' view. Just changing who's in charge doesn't change how society is. So I think Jesus has something far more profound in mind than changing who's ruling Palestine. The basic theme of Jesus' teaching is this. It's from Mark chapter 1, verse 15. The time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe the gospel. This message was basically identical to that of John the Baptist. You can find him saying the same central theme. Except that John portrayed himself as the forerunner and Jesus identified himself as the one who brought the kingdom. Listen to some of the things Jesus had to say about himself. Referring to himself, he said, "And indeed a greater than Jonah is here. And indeed a greater than Solomon is here." He claimed to be new cloth or to be the bridegroom. He says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Not exactly a humble view of himself. Jesus thought he was the person to change people and societies fundamentally. Rather startlingly, he sometimes portrays himself as an immigrant from a different place, come to spend some time with the people of Israel, his people. See his familiar conversation with Nicodemus in John chapter 3. He never said that he came to abolish war, or even to critique it directly. But he did teach certain attitudes that undercut the common causes of war. There is, of course, a vast literature aiming to discern the causes of war. There may be a number of references to that literature or additions to it in the series of talks on war and peace this fall at IU. Today's favorite cause of all social maladies, which is poverty. You know that. Seems not to be one of the causes of war. The endemic tribal warfare of the New Guinea Highlands, for example, seems to be about revenge pig stealing, and women. Great article in the New Yorker in 2008. Guy who's spent a long time with the tribes and tried to figure out why these guys fight all the time. And he keeps finding out the same three reasons. Pigs, women, revenge. That's a little hard on women, isn't it? Same category as pigs. But anyway, that's what he found out. There's a article by Steven Pinker in the Wall Street Journal that I just read a few days ago. That's September 24, 2011, in which he basically argues that wars have nothing to do with poverty except creating it. Genghis Khan and the Mongols were after booty. Jack Weatherford, Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World, 2004, big bestseller. He's as plain as can be. Genghis Khan and the Mongols do not invade China because they are poor. They invade China because they're finally united and they think they have the strength and they think they can pull it off. And they do. The Trojan Wars were begun to redress the personal insult of a runaway wife. Check the Iliad. And back to the women issue. The Punic Wars between Rome and Carthage were about who would control the politics and commerce of the Western Mediterranean world. But they were also about the fact that the Romans thought the Carthaginians were an immoral, dreadful people who sacrificed their own children to their gods, and the Romans were outraged by it. Mm-hmm. Scholars for years says the Romans were exaggerating. Recent archaeological evidence says, no, the Romans understated it. In short, wars are about greed, revenge, hunger for power, fear, recognizable human weaknesses. Poverty interferes going to war. What is going to hinder the U.S. from starting its next war? Our big debts. Wars are expensive. Wealth funds wars. If you plan to go to war, you gather up a lot of money historically, and then you spend it on soldiers and armies, and you go to war. Poverty as the explanation for all social ills is mind-numbingly mindless. Jesus' teaching points in a different direction than a society of conquest or an honor culture of slights revenged, pigs and women, or a society ruled by fears of enemies. A few verses from Matthew about self-assertiveness and, well, listen, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. A few verses from Mark about hunger and power, hunger for power. You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant. Something from Luke about acquisitiveness. Then one from the crowd said to him, Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. But he said to him, Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you? And he said to them, Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. And Jesus continued with a story about a rich man who had such good crops that he thought he could retire and rest for the remainder of his life. But God said to him, Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? And from Luke on fear. And I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body, and after that have no more that they can do. But I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who, after he is killed, has power to cast into hell. Yes, I say, fear him. In each gospel, Jesus appears as a man at ease with the powerful, such as Jairus, the synagogue ruler in Capernaum, or the Roman centurion who came to him for help, but not at all interested in climbing a social ladder. He tells his disciples to let women bring their infants to him. He converses with a Samaritan woman at a well. He eats with Zacchaeus, the collaborating tax collector, and he constantly interacts with Pharisees inside and outside their houses. He evinces no interest in accumulating power, money, or women, the usual goals of able men. He certainly does not sound or feel like a man intent on fomenting rebellion against Rome. He does sound like a man completely familiar with his own countrymen, who had nevertheless been sent from somewhere else. He aimed at a more thorough human renovation than simply replacing one political authority with another. Jesus, in short, aimed at a new world based on himself, which would be born out of the old world and would live in its midst as it matured. That world would have its origin in his death and resurrection, which takes us back to the suffering servant Messiah, a theme we are not pursuing tonight. Finally, Jesus anticipated that the old and the new world would be in conflict. Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Families would divide over him. He intended to leave people with no choice regarding himself and his teachings. He who is not with me is against me, he said. Even today, in most places of the world, the introduction of the name of Jesus into a conversation or a situation will often provoke an argument that quickly becomes personal. There is no one else from ancient history that has this power. There's a fourth aspect of Jesus' career, touching the theme of war, which I have left entirely untouched tonight. The Gospels consistently portray warfare between evil spirits and humanity. In the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples to use, the Lord's Prayer for Protestants, the Our Father for Catholics, the last request is, "Deliver us from the evil one." Jesus, in fact, points to himself as the strong man who can set free men and women who are enslaved to evil. All right, time to conclude. What did Jesus teach about war? Taking the four canonical Gospels as our sources, I conclude, first of all, that he taught nothing directly about war as we usually think of it. His world was at peace. Second, he stood consistently against the rebellious longings of his countrymen, who argued whether paying taxes to Caesar was moral, who named their children after Maccabean heroes, and who sometimes thought they saw in him the hero who could lead them in war. Third, Jesus aimed at a more thorough personal and social renovation than simply replacing one set of rulers with another. As part of this new world, which he personally was bringing, he included new values and ethics which would lead people away rather than toward war. While Jesus is the only figure from antiquity still provoking heated argument, his continuing authority is so great that all sorts of movements wish to claim him. I've already mentioned Gandhi, Martin Luther King, liberation theology, solidarity in Poland, and so on. I think some make a better claim than others. I rather fancy solidarity myself. But all political and social movements that claim his authority mostly miss what Jesus aimed at: a new world based on himself and his teachings, in which men and women transformed by his spiritual power would turn away from the usual modus for war of greed, hunger for power, and revenge.